From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 weeks ago, the world watched as peaceful protesters in Libya came out in defiance of a regime notorious for its brutal suppression of any voices of dissent.
It was anything but safe for anti-Qaddafi protesters who had called for a Friday of liberation.
Qaddafi's forces fired on protesters in Tripoli as they emerged from mosques holding Friday morning.
Every town in eastern Libya was filled with protesters today. People hoping that momentum is on their side and that Gaddafi will be gone in days, if not hours.
But something changed. Suddenly, the media dropped the phrase protester and started talking about rebels instead.
In Benghazi, international news cameras were brought to see rebel fighters training civilian volunteers.
Attacks continued to escalate between government forces and rebels on several fronts.
This side and the west side of Tripoli that were in rebel control. The rebels held on, but the rebels didn't gain any ground either.
The shift in rhetoric may have been subtle to some, but for others it was a jarring change. Rebels, said many in the Twitter sphere, was a pejorative. It was a word that separated the outside world from the struggle for democracy. Foreign policy managing editor Blake Hounshell doesn't see why people should find the word problematic.
I don't find it a negative term at all. There is a certain romanticism, actually, that I think a lot of us have about rebels. A lot of people still like to root for the underdog, and certainly the overwhelming majority of Americans are cheering on the anti-Qaddafi folks in Libya. There's not a lot of love for the Qaddafi side. In my own thinking, just as I was writing sentences myself, I had to think about at different points in the narrative, when do you call someone a protester? When do you call someone a rebel? When do you call someone anti-Qaddafi forces or pro-Qaddafi forces? As a journalist, I think it's a lot more precise and accurate term to use. You can't really call someone with an RPG a protester anymore. At that point, really, they've become a rebel.
So was it at that point at which the world's media decided pretty much together to switch from protester to rebel?
These things often happen almost before you fully realize it, and then you realize it. You begin thinking that word doesn't sound right.
New York Times foreign editor Susan Shearer talks about making the switch.
I couldn't, frankly, pinpoint the moment, but it became clearer and clearer that we were not talking about Egypt or Tunisia-style large demonstrations, but something that had become a military conflict.
She says there are likely to be more semantic shifts in the future to keep pace with the evolving situation in Libya.
We also had a discussion about whether to use the word civil war, and we began introducing that terminology, in effect, for some of the same reasons. We've set a step closer to civil war. I guess we haven't called it a full-out civil war because we're trying to be cautious. I mean, you have actual ground clashes between rebels from the east and Gaddafi loyalists. You have airstrikes. You have loyalist troops on the ground fighting rebel troops on the ground. So that comes a lot closer to the edge of what you could call civil war. I guess we've hesitated to say full-fledged civil war because it has been relatively contained clashes in certain areas.
But you do see the potential for the semantic tide turning toward civil war.
Absolutely, I do. We're watching it. I think it's very close.
What would tip you over?
When I would feel comfortable saying they're in absolute civil war is if we have several running days of extended clashes, ground fighting, extended bombing runs, which have been difficult to completely verify. But I think we're very close to that.
And the challenge to choosing the right terminology is not limited to the fast-changing situation on the ground in Libya, but the evolving nature of what is meant by civil war.
This is a very unusual conflict. I mean, I think civil war is one of those fascinating phrases, because in Iraq, we eventually decided that it could and should be labeled a civil war, even though you didn't really have two armies. You essentially had sectarian conflict fueling mass killing of civilians. It wasn't just combatants. So civil war is a term that has evolved in how it's used. And I think that definition remains an evolving one.
You know, what's interesting is that civil war is also a freighted term. I know the Bush administration did not want it applied to Iraq.
No, they didn't.
Because it would suggest that there isn't any role for foreign governments there. And if that happens in Libya, will that give people leave to walk away from this conflict and not to engage? Does it give foreign powers who are now looking to help a reason to walk away?
we can't be guided by what might happen if we use a term. I am a journalist, and what I do is describe what we see as accurately and precisely as possible. I'm not going to not use a phrase because I think it might influence policy one way or the other. Let's just be accurate, and then, you know, we'll see where the policymakers go.
But words do frame things.
Absolutely.
And civil war is a frame.
Right. Well, that's why we're trying to be careful and cautious. I mean, it's also an uprising. I think that's a word we've used and will continue to use.
Susan Chira is the foreign editor of the New York Times. Several people have told me that the moment they hear the word rebel, they begin to disconnect. The effect is compounded when combined with the phrase civil war. Whether or not people like us on the other side of the world choose to engage or even follow the story is a decision each of us makes every day. We think we make those choices consciously, weighing the expense in time and mental energy with what we stand to gain. But often, we decide without deciding. What we choose can hinge on the unrecognized power of a single word. When journalists say explicitly that they try not to consider how a simple word choice might influence policy or people, politicians take the opposite tack. They want to choose the most influential word or words possible. Some of the most persuasive words are metaphors. Lera Boroditsky, a psychology professor at Stanford University, conducted an experiment to see just how effective metaphorical framing is.
When politicians talk about problems in society, they use metaphors all the time. They're just profligate users of metaphors. And we thought, is that because these metaphors are good for persuasion? Is it because they help people think about complex problems? What is the role that they're playing?
What you did is you took two groups of people and you offered each of them a problem to solve. You created the fictional town of Addison, which was experiencing a crime wave.
Yes, we asked two groups of participants to help us solve the problem of crime rising in the city of Addison. One group, we told that crime was a beast ravaging the city of Addison. We used a beast metaphor. For the other group, we said crime was a virus ravaging the city of Addison. We gave both groups all the same statistics, the rising crime rates, so they had all the same factual information about the city.
The only difference was the metaphor.
The only difference was that one word. Is it a beast or is it a virus? We asked both groups what should be done in Addison to solve the crime problem. The group that got the beast metaphor was much more likely to seek solutions about enforcement and punishment. So they would say, bring in more police, build more jails. The folks that got the virus metaphor came up with quite a different set of solutions. They focused on social reform. So they would say things like, let's improve the education system or let's have better after-school programs.
How strong was this effect?
Well, to find that out, we wanted to compare the size of the metaphor effect to the size of normal opinion differences in the population. So, for example, Republicans and Democrats differ on this issue. Democrats are more likely to think you should use social reform. Republicans are more likely to think that you should enforce and punish. And in fact, we find that split between Republicans and Democrats in our data. But what we find is the metaphor was actually twice as strong as that opinion split between Republicans and Democrats. That suggests to us that the particular framing in which we're entertaining a problem really matters.
Did you get the sense that your survey participants were at all conscious of the impact of the metaphor?
We wondered that, so we asked all of our participants, can you tell us what influenced your decision? People selected the facts and the figures, the crime statistics, and they said that was the most influential. Well, of course, the crime statistics were the same for the two groups, so that couldn't have been the thing that made the difference. The only difference was that metaphor, and almost no one chose it as the important part of the passage.
You even found that the metaphors changed the kind of information that people subsequently asked for.
That's right. And what we found was people foraged for information that was consistent with the metaphor. If they heard that crime was a beast ravaging the city of Addison, they would select information about jails or about police to learn about more and seek out more information about that. And we were interested in that because we thought that would be the kind of process that would help perpetuate the effect of the metaphor.
As you look in the real world outside of the lab, there are certain metaphors, certain frames that just fail, right?
Yeah, it's definitely the case that not every attempt to frame something or reframe something works. And my favorite example of a failed attempt is when the U.S. Congress decided to rename French fries into Freedom Fries a few years ago. During World War I, for example, everything that had a German-sounding name got remade into Liberty something or other. So you would say Liberty cabbage instead of sauerkraut, or Liberty sausage instead of liverwurst. But these days, it's Freedom Fries and Freedom Manicures and Freedom Toast and things like that.
And those don't work, do they?
They don't work because they're based on a bad theory about how language and thought relate to one another. When you make that kind of substitution, when you say, you know what, we can just use the word French and the word freedom in the same context. Any word that you can use in the same context that way is a synonym. And what you're implying with that kind of substitution is that French and freedom are synonyms.
No, that's not what they mean.
It's exactly the opposite of what they're trying to accomplish. You know, so if you carry out the substitution, you would have to say, you know, freedom kissing and freedom poodles. But also, what do you call France? Would it be the land of freedom? What do you call French? Is it the language of freedom? That's clearly not what the substitution is meant to do. So I have my own silly proposal about what to do in situations like that.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to really annoy the French, I say take all the things that the French don't like and call them French. McDonald's would be the French cafe, and you could call Disneyland France. Americans will be French people. That'll really get them.
Lara, thank you very much.
And thanks for having me.
Lara Boroditsky is an assistant professor of cognitive psychology at Stanford University.
Coming up, busting unions and stereotypes in Wisconsin.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As you've probably heard by now, 14 Democratic senators from the state of Wisconsin are on the lam, having fled a few weeks ago to nearby Illinois to avoid voting on a decidedly anti-union piece of legislation. Among other things, the bill would increase public employee contributions to pensions and health care and strip public unions of certain collective bargaining rights. Republican Governor Scott Walker has argued that the measures are needed in light of the state's ballooning budget shortfall. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of public employees took to the streets in protest. And so the standoff continues, with the Democrats standing in for the working man and the Republicans for fiscal responsibility. And what about the unions and their, you know, executives and leaders? And what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, right. Bosses.
Barack Obama is preparing a billion-dollar campaign. With his record, he'll spend every penny. Families are struggling, state budgets have run dry, and the federal debt is skyrocketing. But Obama and the union bosses are standing in the way of economic reform, intimidating taxpayers, leaving classrooms empty. They made this mess. Let's clean it up. Stop Obama and his union bosses today.
That was a Republican National Committee ad released this week, which used the phrase union bosses to imply corrupt bullies, a once common term in anti-union rhetoric. Only this time around, that RNC ad seems to be an exception. Much of the local and even national coverage has been sympathetic to the public employees, which, according to Nelson Lichtenstein, ain't how it used to be. Lichtenstein is the director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he says that unions have historically had something of an image problem.
In the past, when there was a strike or even worse, some scandal, media sort of jumped on that in a fairly negative way. A strike, whether it was for good reasons or bad, disrupts other people, disrupts life, and that's a negative. The strike of the professional air traffic controllers in 1981, which Ronald Reagan jumped on, generated a lot of negative coverage. Some of the same arguments, you know, they're getting paid too much and they should be happy with what they have. And that set off a chain reaction in the private sector, largely in the 1980s, of managements taking a hard line against unions.
According to a Pew study in August 1981, 59% of the public apparently agreed with Reagan that it was worth shutting down the air traffic controllers. But in Wisconsin, a recent Pew study suggests that a wide majority of people support the Wisconsin unions.
Right. And the difference is this. Reagan was elected sort of decisively and moved against these 11,000 relatively small group of workers who had tried to shut down the entire air transportation system. In Wisconsin, there isn't a strike. There hasn't been a strike. And furthermore, we're dealing with a much larger group of workers. Many of them, of course, people know very intimately. And therefore, the situation's reversed.
So you're saying part of the reason the coverage generally has been much more positive is because these are friends and neighbors. These are people that we're more likely to know. You also suggest that it's very telegenic.
Well, yes, because you have these crowds. And, you know, any photograph of them or clip of them shows all sorts of ordinary people, many women, of course, many young people, but also policemen and firefighters and Green Bay Packers, you know, who are out there with these school teachers and social workers and home health care workers. So there's kind of this unusual and across the entire population sort of grouping there.
You mentioned that the traditional demonization of unions and labor hasn't worked or been employed much this time. For example, you don't really hear the term union boss being thrown around that much.
Well, right. One could plausibly use that phrase, although I think incorrectly. When you had union leaders and managers sitting in a closed room, you know, cutting a deal, and that's sort of the essence of collective bargaining. But when you have 50,000 people or more every day out in the streets, the phrase union boss doesn't compute unless you're Gaddafi or something and you think that the uprising is purely a product of a conspiracy of your enemies. It's clear that this has a genuine democratic popular flavor to it, and whether the union leaders want it or not, it's taken place. So I think that has changed some of the rhetoric of the conservatives.
Certainly the phrase has been used in the past, in fact, only a couple of years ago by the Chamber of Commerce, right?
That's right. And the contrast is striking. 2 years ago, when Obama first came in, there was a big push by the labor movement and the Democrats to pass a new bill called the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have made union organizing easier. And the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups spent a lot of money on ads on TV demonizing the union leaders as labor bosses and sort of thuggish on the grounds that they were going to eliminate the election that workers would have to decide whether they wanted a union or not. And so that was actually fairly successful from the point of view of the conservatives. Clearly in Wisconsin, one can't demonize the leadership of the trade unions because you can't sort of order 50,000 people to go out in the streets.
These are not automatons. You mentioned Gaddafi. These are not people who have had hallucinogens put in their Nescafe.
That's correct, yes.
Talk to me a little bit about pop culture, because when I think of how unions are generally depicted mm-hmm. on TV and in the movies mm-hmm. and The Wire, mm-hmm. The Sopranos, mm-hmm. they don't come off too well.
No, they don't. There has been this level of rhetoric and discourse for really a century, which I think quite unfairly puts the phrase boss next to the democratically elected office holder who heads a union. You know, bosses are autocratic figures. More rightly, you'd call a CEO a boss. You'd call Bill Gates a boss. I think that's part of what's seeped into the culture, and I think it reflects the viewpoint of a large section of certainly businessmen and others who think that unions ipso facto are illegitimate, and therefore the only way they exist is because union leaders, union bosses, are putting one over on their own membership.
So is a film like Norma Rae the exception that proves the rule?
Yes, it is. Norma Rae was a, you know, a study of a heroic union organizing drive. But the movie ended at the moment of sort of victory when the union was certified. If the movie had continued for another 3 years, you would have found all the messy details of how to organize a contract, internal conflicts, managers saying, you know, you want too much, you're going to put me out of business. Norma Rae number two would have had a different flavor than Norma Rae number one.
Would you say you're objective on the issue of unions?
Well, I would say that I'm a historian who has seen and understood that the development of democracy in any nation, in any part of the world, is almost always, or is always, joined at the hip with the rise of institutions that represent the working class in some organized fashion.
Nelson, thank you very much.
You're welcome indeed.
Nelson Lichtenstein is the director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Norma, you got the biggest mouth in this mill. Give us a longer break. Give us more smoking time.
Do it. Now shut up.
In response to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-union push, the loose-knit group of netizens, calling themselves Anonymous, took down the website of the Koch brothers' political action committee, Americans for Prosperity. The purported reason? Money from that PAC supported Walker's campaign. Anonymous seems to have its hands in a lot of political actions lately, from supporting WikiLeaks by taking down MasterCard and PayPal's websites, to attacking the websites of North African governments in support of the protesters. Their online weapon of choice is what's called a distributed denial of service attack, which crashes websites by flooding them with messages. On the media has, in the past couple of months, referred to Anonymous as hackers, hacktivists, internet pranksters, even vigilantes. But New York University anthropologist Gabriella Coleman, who has studied Anonymous, says it's more complicated than that. She believes that Anonymous is a microcosm for the entire continuum of online behavior, from its most idealistic to its most nihilistic. Take, for example, its recent attack on Aaron Barr, who was CEO of the security firm H.B. Gary Federal.
Aaron Barr had spoken with a reporter in the Financial Times and had revealed that he had supposedly infiltrated the group and was about to release the real identities of what he called a kind of core group of Anonymous. And a small contingent of Anonymous took almost immediate action, hacking into his Twitter account and taking it over. And they also hacked into the company he works for and downloaded, I believe, 50,000 emails, which then they put on the internet. So this is an example when certain elements of Anonymous were trolling and hacking as other elements were continuing to protest, for example, and lend a helping hand in the Middle East.
I'm glad you raised that point, because that seems to me a structural problem with Anonymous being anonymous. How do they retain their identity as righteous fighters for justice when anybody can go out and create mayhem and blame it on them?
Within each network, there are certain participants who can allow or disallow certain people. And what happens then is that people go elsewhere and set up their own network. Within a network, there are techniques that are used to, quote unquote, keep people in line. When they were engaging in operations in Tunisia, some people were talking about attacking the media. And when you have a swell of people saying, no, no, that's not what we do, it kind of keeps people in line on that network. So there are forms of control. But to be sure, as you noted, anyone can then take the name. And as long as they corral enough human power, they too can lead actions as well.
We were talking about individuals under the banner of Anonymous creating mischief. What happens if, for example, a country engaging in cyber warfare decides to do so masquerading as Anonymous?
While anyone can take the name, people who are familiar with Anonymous, which includes journalists, people like me, other interested parties, could come about and say, look, this may be Anonymous, but it did not spring forth from the networks whereby Anonymous is currently organizing themselves. And so you can sort of respond in the media and say, well, it is, but a name alone.
To some people's way of thinking, Anonymous, or at least some of its elements, have been engaged in actual crimes, including theft of intellectual property and, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. And you would think governments have resources to identify IP addresses and so forth. Is that a threat to this non-organization?
40 subpoenas were issued in the United States for people believed to be participating in Anonymous. In the UK, 5, again, alleged participants were arrested, released, and I believe there'll eventually be a trial. I think when it comes especially to the forms of what I saw as civil disobedience with MasterCard and PayPal, there is an awareness that there are legal consequences to civil disobedience. But if the punishment is something like 10 years in jail, which is what could happen with denial of service tax, I think that there would be a huge, huge protest movement that formed as a response to that. They really have a sense that they are participating in a global stage where the political stakes of questions of information access, transparency, really do matter to the future of democracy. And while, I mean, this is one of the tough things about Anonymous, because it's definitely the case that the trolling and the lulls seem so anti-ethical. And I agree that it really can have those ramifications. I don't want to whitewash that element. But to sort of pigeonhole Anonymous as kind of basement dwellers who are marginalized, who kind of have no lives, who are just exercising their psychological pathology, is really selling this world short.
Anonymous acts in the name of good government and justice and transparency in ways that are unilateral, sometimes arbitrary, and certainly opaque. How does Anonymous justify that, you know, central irony, maybe even hypocrisy?
There are some participants who don't engage in the kind of lulzy, trollish behavior. And so for them, there is no contradiction. What they do is civil disobedience. They help in terms of human rights activism. And yes, they do things in a kind of way that enacts spectacle, but that's actually quite tactical and effective. Anonymous pontificates quite a bit about what it means to be anonymous. They write a lot of documents and manifestos and papers, and this is where you can get a sense of their political sensibility. This is what someone says about anonymity. It says, certainly there is power in accountable free speech. I mean, look at the figures like Martin Luther King or Gandhi. They did incredible things. But there's something lost when it is focused on one person or on one group. People and ideas get swept under the rugs. There's just something spectacular about the necessarily egalitarian nature of a democratic movement on the internet. And what I think is so interesting about Anonymous is the fact that it is a kind of political gateway for a lot of geeks who may have not participated in politics before.
Gabriella, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gabriella Coleman is an assistant professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. And now for a few of your letters. William Cuniff was one of many listeners to respond to our interview with our own producer, Sarah Abdurrahman, who had spent the weekend as a kind of journalist activist, connecting Libyan protesters on the ground with the Libyan diaspora in the mainstream media. He, like many, observed that, quote, at the end of the interview, she started to break down, and as a 56-year-old white guy in middle America, I almost started to cry myself. I could feel her passion for what she's doing. I just wish I could tell her the impact that interview had. On our interview last week about how JCPenney gamed Google to achieve better search results, Ted Bunn of Richmond, Virginia writes, quote, I'm baffled by your use of the words sinister and especially illicit to characterize JCPenney's search optimization strategy. Nothing in your report suggests that anything the company did was illegal. You can bet that all of JCPenney's competitors do their best at search engine optimization. They'd be negligent in their obligation to their shareholders if they didn't. As far as I can tell from your report, JCPenney's only crime was to be better at it. If Google wants to remain preeminent in the search business, its obligation is to plug holes in its algorithm. No one else is obligated to refrain from walking through any holes they find.
About our live show a couple of weeks ago, you either loved it or hated it. Jack Katz of Mesa, Arizona called it, quote, a fantastic show full of important content and still presented in a light and palatable way, respecting the intellect of your audience. But Pat Galloway of Austin, Texas, hated it. Quote, "Ordinarily, I find OTM informative and interesting. For this show, I found it to be disappointingly ill-informed. Please get some researchers who can understand the semantic web and the human labor it takes to make meaning meaningful to a computer. Please grant the topic more seriousness than a roundup of competing sound bites. The most disturbing thing about this show was that I now wonder whether to trust it on other topics."
Wow. Okay. Don't sugarcoat it. Just keep those comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
And here's an update on our Who Killed the Bill project. We're trying to identify the senator who placed an anonymous hold on the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act on the last day of last year's legislative session, effectively killing the bill. We've asked you to contact your senators, and the process has been hugely successful. All but four senators have confirmed that they did not kill the bill. But the four that remain have all been saying the same thing. The anonymous hold is private, none of your business. So we decided to change things up a bit, and we have some questions you can use on the website that ask, why does the senator not reveal his, yes, they're all men, legislative actions to his constituents, especially since support for the bill was said to be unanimous in both houses, and yet one senator is seen fit to kill the bill privately? And so we're asking you again, if you live in the great states of Kentucky, Alabama, Idaho, or Arizona, please call Senators McConnell, Sessions, Risch, or Kyle and ask them why they won't answer the question. And then email us at blowthewhistle@wnyc.org and tell us what they said. You can make this happen. Make government more accountable and make us proud. Coming up, the pros and cons of interviewing felon Bernie Madoff.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Reporter Steve Fishman's profile of Bernard Madoff in New York Magazine garnered quite a bit of media attention this week. Madoff, of course, is one of the most infamous criminals in history, the perpetrator of a more than $50 billion Ponzi scheme, who's currently serving a 150-year prison sentence. When we read Fishman's piece, we wondered about the background negotiations that resulted in the profile. How did he reach Madoff? Why did Madoff, who presumably is being courted by many journalists, agree to an interview with Fishman? So we asked Fishman to tell us the story behind the story. Turns out he'd been trying to reach Madoff for months, years actually, sending him letters, books, all of which were returned by prison officials. None of his persistence was working until one day he heard from a guy named Robert Rosso, one of Madoff's fellow convicts, who became a sort of de facto fixer. Fishman tells the story.
I got a hold of a list of everybody who was in prison with him. I wrote to everybody who was still in prison at that point, and got several responses, including from Robert Rosso. Rosso and I started communicating, and one day I said to him, can you do me a favor? I have this letter. I think I understand Madoff and his position. I just can't communicate it to him. Could you give him this letter? And he agreed to do that.
Okay, Robert Rosso, tell me something about this guy. He doesn't exactly have the resume of a New York Magazine intern.
He has served really hard time in penitentiaries, where he rose to the top of the prison hierarchy, organizing gambling games, running the drug trade from inside prison, all the while sustaining a pretty healthy heroin and alcohol addiction.
And yet he played a pivotal role in you landing the Madoff interview, because it turns out there is another side to Robert Rosso.
He is a writer of some talent, and he found in Bernie Madoff a subject that he knew would garner wide attention. So he's been writing missives from prison, where he walked the track with Bernie Madoff, became a friend of Bernie Madoff, and he had asked Madoff for months for an interview, actually, as he said, for the first interview. And then Madoff's son, Mark, committed suicide. And as Rosso told me, he didn't have the heart to press the point. Then one day, Rosso was informed that he was being moved out of Madoff's prison. And he decided, He had a jump at that moment. In the yard, he gives Madoff a list of 12 or 13 questions, and Madoff, within a couple days, gives him written answers.
I'm looking at the interview between Robert Rosso and Bernie Madoff on Robert Rosso's website, and he asked about it, Madoff's typical day in prison. He asked him what kind of books Madoff reads. Here's another one. Do you have any suggestions about how to get the economy back on track? Answer, no. Question, what is your take on the recommendations of the Hamilton and Volcker committee? Madoff answers, it is obvious that Volcker was unhappy with the government reforms. His suggestions were correct, but as usual, Wall Street won the day. It is absolutely astounding that nobody in the investment banks faced criminal charges. I'm just astonished that Robert Rosso went in this direction. What did you think of his brand of journalism?
I think it's a fascinating artifact. He enjoys speaking to Bernie Madoff because the conversations are not like every other conversation he has, which is obsessed with prison politics, as he told me. Who's getting thrown in the hole? Who's got a certain hustle? And now he can sit with a Bernie Madoff and, as Rosso told me, speak about credit default swaps and the financial reform regulation. The interesting advantage that Rosso has as a journalist is that, you know, he's not a guy who is going to insist on remorse. It's not a setting where you need to demand that Madoff justify himself. You know, there is a fascination with Madoff in prison. People are interested in the fact that he's the greatest financial criminal in history in their midst. And they're particularly interested in that aspect of his accomplishment. You know, the way he succeeded in their field.
Okay, so that was his interview. How precisely did that lead to your interview?
He then felt that not being a journalist, he said, you know, I'm not Oprah or Larry King. He felt that there was a value to having me talk to Madoff as well. Frankly, I think it tickled him to be the PR person for Bernie Madoff. He actually was in communication with lots of journalists, the New York Times, the New York Post, you know, Vanity Fair. So he is somebody who is sophisticated about the media to a certain extent and reached out. And for whatever reason, he and I kind of developed this simpatico that let us take it further.
So tell me about the moment you actually heard from Madoff. The phone rings one day and...
I actually missed the first phone call. Because you have to push all these buttons. You have to listen to this message and push buttons if you accept and push buttons if you deny or want to block the call. And the first time I heard the message, I pushed the wrong button, which had me paralyzed, having made a career misstep of enormous proportions. But then he fortunately called back.
You have a direct call from
Bernard Madoff,
an inmate at a federal prison. To hear the cost of this call, press 8 now.
And then, you know, there was this voice.
Bernie?
Yes, Steve.
Hi.
Okay, listen, before I forget, I don't think it's
this voice, you know, this kind of Queens, outer borough guy on the end of the line, and somebody that I'd been writing about for so long that at some points I felt like I could kind of channel his thoughts, which I know sounds weird, but there, you know, there is a moment at which you kind of get into a subject where you feel like you understand him or her.
I tried to return funds to my friends. I tried to return monies to the smaller clients and so on. They wouldn't take it back. I mean, the abuse I got from people, how could
he's not a guy who ducks behind lawyers. He would go anywhere, talk about his son's suicide, talk about his scheme, how he got into it. So there was this kind of extraordinary exchange that I certainly couldn't have predicted or expected, but that I was really delighted to engage in.
All right, Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Fishman's profile of Bernard Madoff appeared in New York Magazine. We'll link to Fishman's piece and to Rosso's profile from our site, onthemedia.org.
Last week, Canada's equivalent of the FCC, the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission, announced that its regulation forbidding Canadian newscasters from broadcasting lies on the air will not be changed. The committee had discussed a proposal which would have softened the blanket prohibition on falsity on Canadian TV news. Broadcasters wouldn't be liable for lies that were accidental or harmless. But Canadians revolted, the commission relented, and the result is that the Canadian law against online fabrication remains strict. University of Ottawa law professor Michael Geist followed the controversy. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the regulatory body was asked to consider changing the regulation. It decided not to change it. That means that there is still the blanket prohibition on false or misleading information. So what are the consequences if you break this rule?
Well, if you break the rule, in theory, you could lose your license or face significant penalties. We haven't seen the rules applied. There's a bit of a reticence on the part of the regulator to seek to apply those rules, even in instances where the provision might actually apply.
As far as I know, no one has ever lost their license as a result of presenting false or misleading information. I can't believe that Canadian broadcasters never lie. So why are they so reticent to enforce this rule?
Well, I think you're probably right. I'm sure there are instances where there are broadcasts that are false. I suppose, in a sense, the regulator may have almost been reading in a higher threshold. I suspect that were a case of false or misleading news to come to light, one of the first questions they'd ask before trying to proceed down the road of enforcing the rule is whether or not there was actually a knowledge present. So did the broadcaster knowingly broadcast something that they knew to be false, or was there something that was broadcast false inadvertently or through a mistake? And so while the law itself doesn't distinguish, it certainly is in the realm of possibility that the regulator does in the extent to which they're looking to enforce those rules.
So is this law effective despite the fact that it's never enforced? Does it have the effect, do you think, of dissuading would-be liars? Could you even know?
That's a good question. And in many ways, I suppose it's hard to know. Quite frankly, it's been such an obscure provision that most people weren't even aware of it. It's only when the CRTC, the regulator, proposed to change it that suddenly it started capturing some real attention.
Real attention. My understanding is that Canadians got as upset as Canadians can get. Explain to me how much of a lightning rod it was.
Well, it was one that generated thousands of Canadians to respond. It got a lot of coverage. It was even discussed on the floor of the House of Commons. And there were those that thought there was these sinister, deep secret motivations behind it.
Why?
Well, part of it actually stems from the regulator itself, who's been in the public eye on a number of issues, and this was, in a sense, just piling on. Beyond that, I think that there was some concern, or at least attempts to link this particular proposal with the imminent entry of a new broadcaster into the marketplace, Sun TV, dubbed by some as Fox News North in Canada. The regulator has been adamant that there is no connection. But there were some who argue that surely this wasn't pure coincidence, the entry into the marketplace of a potentially more controversial news broadcaster that might push the envelope a little more, might be happy to have some additional legal protection, knowing that the ability to broadcast something false or misleading wouldn't carry the same sort of penalty or wouldn't have the same sort of barrier they were facing under the previous rule.
Was Fox invoked a lot?
Oh, unquestionably. And so Fox is sort of the poster child for the view of a more polarized kind of television. And I suppose there are many in Canada who don't want to see that as yet another American import.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dr. Michael Geist teaches law at the University of Ottawa.
A new website in the UK called Churnalism.com aims to help the public distinguish between independent journalism and reports that simply regurgitate information from publicists. Martin Moore is the director of the Media Standards Trust, the nonprofit that's launched the site. He explains that he finds the articles and relies on his readers to find the press releases that were the original source. The site allows users to compare those press releases with the actual articles to see how much they overlap.
The site was inspired by research suggesting that over half of news articles were at least
in some part based on press releases. And one understands why people would cut and paste a quote from a press release. One can understand why people would cut and paste figures. But whole great chunks of it, you know, in some cases over 60 or 70%, you start to really question actually the degree to which this is original journalism at all. Our hope is, to a certain extent, it will empower journalists when they are approached by people in public relations, when they're put under enormous pressure by their editor to churn out copy based on press releases, that they will be able to push back and say, listen, I do not want to be labeled a journalist.
Well, I've spent quite a number of years watching the Avengers. So I have this image of a bunch of rumpled people in sort of tweedy clothing going out there and doing good. But I also happen to know that you went off type by conducting a sting operation. Tell me about it.
We realized a few weeks before we launched the site that we were in a catch-22, in that here we were building a site and we would rely on the public to paste in press releases and to find press releases for us. But there was a very good chance the public would never know about us, because why would the press talk about us and print articles about us when we were criticizing them and trying to expose this kind of relationship between public relations and journalism? So we went to chat to an independent film director called Chris Atkins. And Chris quite rightly said, well, best way to let people know about journalism is to do journalism, to create a bunch of press releases based on fake news stories. I mean, stuff that's silly and funny, and if you do a bit of digging, easy to find out that it's not real. But to put out there and to see if news organizations pick it up and they publish it.
You invented a product and created a website for it, and it is the most preposterous idea ever forwarded as a consumer good. One that no journalist with any sense of skepticism would ever run unchecked.
Well, Chris invented what he called the chastity garter belt, which a woman would put around her thigh and had built-in technology which would record by various clever scientific means, like her rising pulse rate and moisture levels on her leg, whether or not she was about to be unfaithful. And if she was, it would text a message to her partner warning him so he could rush back and either forestall or catch her before she did. So.
And just to reiterate, no news organization, no matter how slipshod, could pick up a press release about this product and run it without checking to see if the thing is real. Never, ever, ever.
Just in time for Valentine's Day, nothing says love like lingerie that sends a text when your lady is about to be unfaithful. The chastity garter comes equipped with a hidden microchip that claims to detect a rapidly rising pulse and surface moisture levels on the skin. If these telltale signs of arousal occur, a text is sent to alert the woman's husband or boyfriend. It comes in lace or silk and costs about $100.
Wait, couldn't she also be attacked by a lion or something? Wouldn't that jump your pulse rate up a little bit?
Or playing tennis.
Where was that from?
That was WGN-TV in Chicago. The story was picked up by the Times of India in the States, in Slovakia, in Greece, in Israel, all around the world. Once one large news organization has published something, then many other news organizations accept that the story has been verified and the story is properly sourced and therefore pick it up and don't question it themselves. That has a domino effect.
You also investigated the practice of finding news sources on Facebook. How did that work out?
Well, we were curious not only about news outlets cutting and pasting text from press releases, but also from social networks like Facebook and others. And there was a particular story about number 10, where the prime minister lives and his office is, adopting a rescue cat, which they called Larry. This story went literally all over the newspapers, all over the 24-hour news television stations. It was the topic of discussion for a week. So Chris put together a Facebook page by a character, a pseudonym, Tim Sutcliffe, calling to return what he suggested was not actually Larry the cat, but Joe the cat, to its rightful owner, who was his aunt Margaret, who had lost the cat just a month or so previously. And he wrote up some text explaining it was clearly his aunt Margaret's cat and waited to see what happened. And sure enough, one of the biggest news websites, not just in the UK, but in the world, saw the story, copy and pasted the story, and published the story, not just online, but initially on the page 3 of the paper, complete with a photo of Aunt Marge standing beside the photograph of Joe the cat, with claims from her nephew that she would be looking for DNA tests to prove that the cat was, in fact, hers.
Martin, I have to ask you, Are you real?
Yes, it's funny you should ask that, because there were quite a number of people wondering whether actually this was a hoax of a hoax. There is an industry journal for the public relations industry, and they published a big piece today, highly critical of of our site. The irony being, of course, that we weren't asked for comment. They did rely on a press release, but we then were contacted to ask if we would like to respond. And I said, how do you mean? What do you mean, with an article or with a statement? And I was told, no, with a press release. And at which point I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. So it goes on.
And on and on and on. Martin, thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you.
Martin Moore is director of the Media Standards Trust, a nonprofit in the UK. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gallietti, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.